order this meeting of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee on Monday, February 9th. The record will show that there's a quorum present. Our first item is to return to the minutes of February 2nd.
Madam Chair, do we have those? I've looked through my packet. I see the 4th. I don't see the minutes for the 2nd, at least in my packet.
We'll just do the minutes from February.
Well, I'll move the 2nd. I just don't.
4th.
I just don't have them.
That's all. No.
Okay.
We'll come back to them. They're done. We just don't have copies of them here. So would members look at the minutes from February 4th?
The ones we do have.
Are there any corrections? Seeing none, Senator Marty moves approval of the minutes from February 4th. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes stand approved. Senator Bach is not present, so we will move to Senate File 307. Senator Rolstein.
Madam Chair, I don't know if there's enough time yet for this bill.
Oh, we'll see for that.
Take all the time you need.
Madam Chair, members, I'm pleased to be before you today with an effort to try to streamline government and have Minnesota counties here, so they're going to present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe Matthews.
It's that hard, is it?
Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. In very simple explanation, it's a simple bill. There is a mandate that counties maintain an out-of-state travel policy. And currently, they're required to reveal that travel policy each year. This simply allows you to put a travel policy in place and then not go through the busy work each year of going through an annual review. So pretty cut and dry. It's supported by the Association of Minnesota Counties, also the Minnesota Inter-County Association. And we're not aware of any opposition to repealing this mandate.
Well, it's not really repealing the mandate. It's
no, it's leaving it us of the annual review.
And Senator Rolstein, we're probably going to include this in our omnibus mandate relief bill as well, but I'm happy to send it on separately, too, if that's what you would like.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, thank you. This may be the year we want them to review their out-of-state travel policy. Are most counties doing that?
Yes. Counties are required, as you can see in statute, Madam Chair. Senator, to review this annually, and so they do that. The issue from our perspective is it really becomes busy work because once the policy is in place, it really doesn't change much from year to year, and they would not be precluded from doing that at any time of going in and reviewing it or updating it as needed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
What I was getting at was, did any of them put a moratorium on out-of-state travel or are reviewing it because of budget concerns right now?
Madam Chair, Senator,
Mr. Matthews.
My recollection is that this was put in place in 03 or 04, 05, somewhere around there, because people did not have policies in place at that time. And so they did now go to reviewing that issue. And so I can't speak to what every individual county has done, but I know that it did raise some awareness of the issue to make sure that folks were being prudent with their public resources as far as how they traveled and what they did with those monies. I hope that answers your question. I'm sorry, I don't have a specific answer in all 87 counties.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Matthews, just out of curiosity, because I know there are a number of things the legislature requires like this. When a county board has a policy like this and they're not expecting to change it, what does a review consist of? Does the county board say, oh, we looks good to me? I mean, do they... what do they do?
Mr. Matthews.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, it really amounts to more or less a lot of busy work, I think, from our board's perspectives. And again, as you can see, it has to be made available for public inspection. And so unless there's a reason to change it, it really has just become busy work in that sense. And we're just trying to eliminate some of that as we go through. I know the chair has been very helpful in those discussions. And I think, as she mentioned, the omnibus bill we'll be trying to do a lot more. This is just kind of the first toe in the water.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Rolstein.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, my years on the county board, this would be buried in a consent agenda somewhere, and that would be it.
Members, we Senator Gerlach and Senator Lori and I are currently meeting to identify those areas for both counties, cities, and townships and general government mandates to come up with a group of them to for the committee to decide or and to discuss. Number one, in a number of different groups. Number one, those that are obsolete or meaningless and or should be repealed outright. This would not be one of those. It's just being amended. Then secondly, those that should be suspended. And if we are going to recommend suspension, probably they would be suspended for a period of 4 years. And so the out biennium as well to December 31st of 2013. Others that we would recommend to you to be suspended, but the legislature required to review them in 2011, and then others that would be that the recommendation would be to amend, and this one would be in a, one that we would recommend to amend. If there are now in the future bills that come in that are separately rather than our work, that our mandate relief, we will lay them over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. But we're going to act on this one today separately and then maybe include it in that bill as well. Is there further discussion? Is this a consent calendar item? Senator Marty, or Senator Olsen, without objection, moves that Senate File 307 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Rolstein. Before we move on to Senator Bach's bill, we're going to hear from Mr. Mulder and AMC's presentation of the Minnesota Redesign Project, which I believe all members got a copy of. And which has already been the subject of discussion. As we began getting those lists of mandates from counties and townships and cities, we did have a prior discussion with Mr. Mulder and invited him to come and make a presentation of this redesign project that AMC has been working on. I might add, too, that with regard to mandates, we are reviewing them all. There's going to be many of them, of course, that we consider to be appropriate state policy and will not be repealing, amending, or suspending. Mr. Mulder, welcome to the committee, and pleased to have your report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Mulder. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I'm thank you for the opportunity to visit with the committee about the redesign project. The redesign project, and please ask questions as I go along because I sometimes get into this role and just stop me. The redesign project is really something that started almost 4 years ago. As we were looking at a lot of the issues that counties were facing and even the role of county government generally, we were very concerned about our relationships with each other, between counties, with the cities, the schools, and with also with the state. At that time, we invited a gentleman to come in named Carl New, who is a noted national speaker on local government and does a lot of work with local government. And he talked to us, and really a lot of what we've done was based on some of his work, but also the work we had done, which some of the conditions and some of the concerns that we have about how we are doing business and how government does business as counties, cities, schools, and the state. The first of those concerns was is that the local, the state and local government partnership is waning. As we looked across the nation, as he looks across the nation, he had seen the devolution of from the Fed to the state to the local governments, issues around mandates, the preemption issues, the initiative and referendum, which fortunately we do not have, and then even at times almost an open hostility, not necessarily in Minnesota, but across the nation between state and local governments. And this could, and particularly if you would go, for instance, to Texas, California, there are a number of states where this hostility is just very blatant and open between local governments and the state. The second issue that they that he identified was that the erosion of local government's fiscal health, more and more local governments were relying on property taxes and do across the country. In some states, local governments have the power to enact sales taxes or income taxes, but generally speaking, the ability to raise money at the local level was becoming more and more difficult. It was very difficult to have long-term sustainability and viability. Often these were with initiatives around TABORs or reducing tax capacities. And then additionally, the costs were increasing substantially. The third issue was that the public, and I think probably one of the most, is that the public was starting to lose confidence in how we do business. That we were redundant, that we were fragmented, competitive, and inefficient. And I think a lot of that is just the nature of politics, but it was also the fact that that the public became more informed. County government historically has often been the hidden level of government, that the citizens don't know what we do. We did a survey at about this time where we asked the Himley Horner Group to do a survey of 800 citizens across the state. And we had good news, we had bad news, and we had the really bad news. The good news was is that over 80% of the folks that looked at county government or answered the question said, we really do a good job. But less than 50% of the people knew what we did. And then the really bad news was the more they knew what we did, the less they liked us. So we were kind of faced with, well, what do you do? Maybe we just stay, you know, keep them ignorant. They like us when they don't know what we do. Or maybe it made a lot more sense to do a better job of telling people what we did. The fourth issue was is that citizens were not engaged with or by governments. And in fact, there was a lot of there's a lot of anti-government type mood out there. We felt it was important that the public had to be re-engaged in the decision-making. The public had to recognize that services were delivered at the local level, and they had to be engaged in how those services were delivered within their communities. And then the fifth was a general erosion of grassroots government. And again, it was a lot of these just kind of the fundamentals that we think that we were founded on as counties were being fragmented and disjointed, and we were struggling to try to figure out how can we be effective in the delivery of services if the public has a sense that we either don't do it well or don't know what we did. So we came really, the first decision that we really made was in 2004 and 2005. We went through what was really a simple equation, which was we asked the first question, which was, is the current model for service delivery sustainable? Can we continue to do things that we've always done them? If we can, if the model worked really is working, but it's just a problem that the folks don't know what we do, then we just had to do a better marketing campaign. We had to go out and tell people what we did and just market and spend a whole lot of money on marketing. We really came to the conclusion that the model itself was probably not sustainable. We recognized that we could not continue to deliver services the way we had always been delivering them, particularly because the need for those services and the demand for those services was growing, and the number of services that we provide had grown substantially from the 1960s. The second question was, if we just had more money, would that result from money as a result of legislative action or from economic growth, would that solve the problem? If the legislature just gave us more money to do this stuff, would that make it all work right? Well, we looked at that and came to the realization that that wasn't going to happen. There isn't more money. And the reality is, and we understand the legislature to understand that that we are never, county government would never be at the top of the list. We recognized, even though we deliver services to senior citizens, we deliver other services, K-12 education, there are certain things that are really core to the state responsibility for funding. We think we are very important. We think we're core, but we pretty much realized that there would not be enough money. So if you go to the probably not, the third question was probably the most important. Are you willing to let others control and shape the reform agenda? And we came to the realization that if yes, then we just had to do marketing for you folks. We just had to market the legislature to convince you to do things, or otherwise, and hope that you had great ideas. But we really came to the conclusion that we didn't want to do that. We wanted to take charge of our destiny as county government. We wanted to be responsible for finding a model and finding the delivery of services that make more sense for all of us. So we began our process and really came to recognize that counties are too, in what makes us uniquely different in many ways than the cities or the other local governments, we serve two functions. On the one hand, we are a local government. We provide services as if we were local governments, as if we're a city. We respond to the demands of our citizens. We all of that kind of stuff. The second thing is we are an administrative arm of the state. And probably, and if you go back into the history of county government, we always have been, although it's probably never been so clear that that is our role until probably the last 50 years. If you were a county board in the 1850s and all the way through about 1900, the county board would meet once or twice a year. You did two things. One is you levied taxes for the operation of the various elected officials and their offices, the auditor, the treasurer, the recorder, and all those folks. The second thing you did is roads. If you were the road commissioner back in those days, and you were responsible for making sure that citizens participated in the building of roads. For instance, if you were a citizen in Minnesota, you were required, if you were 18 and you were male, you were required to put in one day per year on the county roads, working on the county roads. And if that assessment was passed, you could work off your assessment of whatever the dollar amount was by earning $3 a day. It was worth $3 a day for each day that you would work on the county roads. Well, obviously, we don't do that anymore. We started to see changes in the early 1900s and then big changes in the 1960s. If you were a county commissioner in the early 1960s, about 15% of your budget would go to health and human services. About 65% of your budget would go to roads and bridges. Today, those numbers are almost flipped. Today, about 20% of our budget would go to transportation and roads, bridges, and those kinds of things. And 60 to 65% would go to health and human services. So, and most of those are done at the behest of the state or federal governments. We felt that the county government, and really what we came to the conclusion was, is that what we do is not sustainable. It just literally, we cannot continue to do business like this. We said that counties, we must redesign how services are delivered and how they are paid for. And to do that, we move forward with recognizing that the partnership between the state and counties, particularly the financial partnership, had to be redesigned. What we were doing and what we have been doing really encourages inequities and inefficiencies that are damaging to both communities and citizens. Now, it isn't that the services are not good. It is not that services aren't needed. It is not all of those positive things. But the way we are doing it encourages a system which is not efficient. It does not encourage innovation. It does not encourage, because so much of what we do is based on how much do we spend and not on the outcomes that we are trying to achieve. So to do that, we recognize that the future for Minnesota is just filled with uncertainties. We recognized, again, that it was unsustainable, and that we really needed to create a vision, a new vision, a bold vision for what we need to do to make it more acceptable. And to do that, we had to say that vision had to be about meaningful solutions. It wasn't literally, and we don't mean, we can't just move the deck chairs around. Literally, we had to rethink everything that we're doing. We talked about, for instance, how we have 130 dispatch centers in the state. The state itself has 10 of them. Now, the reason the state has 10 dispatch centers is because back in the 1980s, we had mobile phones, and mobile phones were attached to your car. And therefore, we, as a legislature and as counties, seem to make a lot of sense that if the phone is attached to the car, the highway patrol should be the people who respond to anything that happens with that vehicle. Well, today, some of these dispatchers centers are responding to all cell phones. When you get a cell phone call at the state dispatch center, basically they forward it to one of the other dispatch centers. Technically, we believe that you could get by with about 30 dispatch centers in this state. For instance, Big Stone County has now contracted with Candio High County to do some dispatch, that Candio High County will do the dispatch for Big Stone County. If you know your map of Minnesota, what's interesting is there's a county in between the two of them. They are not adjacent to each other. We have the opportunity, we believe, to, and the governor has signed an order, an executive order, to begin the process to reduce that 130 dispatch center to something much more manageable. We believe that the solutions will be shared. They'll be shared with cities and counties and schools and towns and the state. We also believe that the vision for the ultimate vision of the redesign project is to really to ensure that the services are delivered at the community level. The reality is that the citizen does not care what color police car shows up on their door when they need a policeman. I live in Senator Marty's district, and I just barely into Roseville, but if you went to the intersection of Larpenteur and Rice, at any one particular moment, you could see the sheriff, you could see the St. Paul police, you could see the Maplewood police, you could see the Roseville police, and you could see the highway patrol. We sometimes ask the question, why? We've asked the question, for instance, some of our most talented and literally most expensive officers across the state are the highway patrol. Great people. They do a fantastic job. But they're used as basically as traffic and road patrol officers. If there's a weakness in county government in some of our smallest counties is the need for advanced detective work. Would it make more sense for in some of our counties that the sheriff or the local officers would do road patrol and the highway patrol might be the folks that would provide an advanced detective work where you maybe see a murder once every 5 years, 7 years, or a drug crime? We think that there are, we don't know that those are the right answers, but we believe that those are the kinds of things, the questions, that has to be answered so that we can solve problems at the community level. We also believe that when you think about community, the community that exists up in Kitson County or in my home county of Renville is a much different community than the one that might exist here in St. Paul or in Minneapolis or in Rochester. We need to provide the flexibility and focus on outcomes to allow those services to be delivered. When we looked at this, we also felt that you couldn't, we actually failed miserably as we started our project. Because originally in our project, we talked about, well, we were going to look at just service after service after service, and we were going to fix them. We were going to have a recommendation about every service. In fact, we started with, there were two of them. One of them was the 911 system. And I can remember the first meeting we had, and we had folks from the Department of Public Safety, some highway patrol people come in, and they were wearing guns. And we immediately knew that this was going to be a very difficult discussion about change. We also talked about something which was food and beverage licensing, which we have both the state is sometimes responsible in some counties and the counties are responsible in some
counties. Mr. Mulder, I'm sure that you did not mean to disparage.
Oh, absolutely. No, believe me, I don't mean to disparage.
You may want to correct your statement.
I apologize. But it there is a lot of ownership by folks whenever we talk about these kinds of things. And it's a simple way to make a point, and I apologize if anybody was offended by that. But what we did know is on food and beverage, for instance, there are two ways of delivering the service, and it is confusing to the public to know who is responsible. Is it the county or is it the state? So we found these three fundamentals that we looked at. One was in the area of governance, one was in the area of transparency, and the other was in flexibility. On the issue of governance, our folks are very frustrated, I would have to say, because oftentimes the responsibilities and outcomes are not necessarily attached to at an appropriate level. For instance, when we receive a mandate, oftentimes we are required to, or a maintenance of effort, we're required to raise the dollars to pay for something, while at the same time we have no decision about who gets to have the service. A great example, for instance, would be we are required to pay for 20% of the cost of an individual who is in a nursing home if they're under 65 years old. The other 80% is paid for by the state, or I'm sorry, by the federal government. Now, county commissioners have no control over who happens to be 65 and ends up in a nursing home or under 65, but yet we pay for it. Our sense was that there needs to be a more clear connection, a more clear nexus between when you are paying and what you are making decisions for. A second would be the sense of accountability. If you have that same sense, how do you hold county commissioners accountable for the raising of property taxes to pay for that 20% when they have no input on whether or not they were going to raise it? When we look at our budget and, for instance, in our maintenance of effort areas, and for the work that we do with the Department of Social Services and with the other departments that have maintenance of efforts, we have our best estimate right now that of the $2.5 billion that counties raise in property taxes, about $700 million of those dollars go for are paid because of maintenance of efforts. The vast majority of them are good things. This isn't about whether they are good or bad, but how do you explain to the citizen that 700, literally a little more than a quarter of the taxes that you are paying in property taxes are to take care of state maintenance of efforts? Good programs, but you're held accountable as a county commissioner because of that. The third issue is that we decided we had to deliver within the governance is how do you deliver effective services, which we think the focus has been so much on process that we have lost the kind of sense of what is effective and what are the outcomes. The second area that we are very concerned about is the area about transparency. And again, we need to make sure that within the accountability system and responsibility of the system is transparent. You have to be a pretty astute citizen to understand when federal dollars, state dollars, or local dollars are being spent for depending on which program. The third area is the area of flexibility and outcomes. And again, we went back to and we look at a lot of the things that we are doing. And in the area of outcomes, most of what we do has been defined by our inputs. For instance, some of you may be aware of the mental health maintenance of effort. Counties are responsible for, in 2003, we passed a maintenance of effort for mental health. And counties were required to continue to pay what they had paid in 2003. Well, that is measuring an input. We had a situation. We have literally 20 counties this past year who were cited by the state for failure to meet their maintenance of effort. The reason, there's many different reasons, and one of the reasons that we had was, for instance, in Clay County, in the year that this was set, they were boarding some of their clients at the Fergus Falls Treatment Center. The Fergus Falls Treatment Center was being closed down, but part of the responsibility for that center was to continue to keep enough revenue coming in the doors so that it was a break-even proposition. So at the end of that center, they were charging $600, $700, $800 a day for people staying there. The county, after they were moved out and after the center was closed, has put them in community facilities where the cost is $200 and $250 a day. The total reduction in cost was between $400,000 and $450,000 for the county. And yet the county was cited because they did not maintain their maintenance of effort. Now, sure, they could have found other reasons, I suppose, to spend the money, but the clients that were being served in 2003 were still being served. We had another case. One of our small counties was cited for $60,000. Literally, in that particular county, which is a small county, two of the people that were being served had moved out of the county. And the county was cited that they needed to find more people. And there were other things they could have spent it on. And I know that will be the argument, is that there are not enough resources to pay for everything that needs to be done out there. But at some point, we believe that when you focus on outcomes, you will get more innovation if you have the opportunity to have some of the benefit of your innovation accrue to the citizens of that area. There's a motivation involved when you can say, hey, we're going to provide great services, but we're going to reduce the cost of those services by innovation. Tell me what you want to have done. How you would deliver services, again, up in Kitson County would be very different than how you might deliver services here in St. Paul or Roseville or wherever it is. Our plan was really to use the redesign document to focus the public policy debate on the issues of governance, transparency, and outcomes. Most of you received this document, and what we wanted to, and sometimes people have been confused when they've seen it, and they think that this is the compilation of all of the things that we want to change. These are only representative of some of the things that we believe that need to change. They range in practically every part of government that counties participate in. We have numerous recommendations about court systems. We talk about, and we've had conversations about having judges be participating in using the most expensive person in our system. At times, our referees in a divorce case where two people are just plain mad at each other. We have our judges spending time on name changes, valuable court time. When somebody wants to change their name, it has to go before the judge. We have talked about the use of televideo conferencing. For instance, if you're out in Traverse County and you have a trial going on and you need somebody from the BCI or BIA, I guess it is, and you want, they have to drive out there so that they can testify for 15 or 20 minutes, maybe it would make sense to allow us to use televideo conferencing to do that. We think there are just numerous ways that we need to rethink how we do business, and hopefully our redesign project will inspire people to have that conversation. As we've looked at it, we recognize that these are short-term issues, there are certainly medium-term issues and long-term issues. We recognize that with the budget crisis that we are in today, that we cannot ask the legislature to expend more money or relieve us of mandates that would cost the state more money. And we will not be asking you to do that. We recognize that in those cases where we are the match for federal dollars, we will not ask the legislature to relieve us of the burden at this time to that would increase your budget problem. What we are asking, though, is that you allow us and work with us to identify those kinds of mandates, those kinds of maintenance of efforts, those kinds of matches, those kinds of all of the things that we do, and give us some of the relief and flexibility that we need so that we can make the changes that we believe are necessary for county government across this state. As somebody was visiting with me yesterday, they said, well, Jim, isn't it all alike? And I said, no. I said, when you think about mandates, and I think this will be one of your challenges as you move forward, there are program mandates, there are process mandates, and there are basically reporting mandates. In a number of cases, we are not going to ask you to repeal the program mandate. We agree with you. That's part of the role of county government, to deliver programs at the behest of the state. We're not going to ask you to make a change in many of those. We probably will ask you to look at the process and invite you to change the process of how we deliver those mandates, and in some cases of how we report. There are large ones, Representative Osteen probably has one that is probably not high on the radar screen. There's others at that level. But there are other serious issues that we need to focus on. In maintenance of effort, for instance, we do want a conversation about the maintenance of effort and the match. It is actually a match program for library services. We do want to look at chemical dependency of currently it's a match system, maintenance of effort system that is absolutely confusing. If anybody, we've had some staff at the legislature looking at it, and they can't figure it out and can't figure it out how it works. It's been around since 1983. So our goal and our hope is, and we appreciate the work that the chairperson has done, in allowing us to have the opportunity to talk about these things. And hopefully, over the course of this session and next session and in the future, we can change the culture in how we work together. We have the best interests of citizens at heart, whether you're as state legislators or whether as county commissioners or city councilmen. But we need to find a way to deliver those services effectively and efficiently and in the best interests of the citizens of Minnesota. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
thank you, Mr. Mulder. We really do appreciate, thoughtfulness with which this project was approached, and even though in terms of some of the individual things I'm not going to agree with them, but that's neither here nor there. What I'm reminded of is a project that NCSL had during the Clinton administration, and maybe you remember it, but it was a special group that, and I was part of it, that where we were having all these discussions about sorting out, and that one of the things that we were looking at is what are the proper responsibilities of state government and what are the proper responsibilities of local governments, and what steps should we take to discover what those things really are and how to go about holding them accountable in their various groups. And the federal government was undertaking that with regard to state governments. The federal government, of course, having sovereignty, and the state governments having limited sovereignty, and local governments having no sovereignty. And cities and counties are creatures of the state statutes. In all states, they are... on the other hand, the statutory relationship that Minnesota has with its county systems is only, I think, replicated in 12 other states. It's a very small number, because in other states counties do not perform that agency relationship for the states. And the discomfort I have in moving forward with this is not is how big a risk the state is willing to make, because what I am reminded of is all of the opportunities in school districts that have come about for having local control of a school through site councils, for example, and these indeed were going to be experiments in democracy within a school, not just a school district, but within a school. And I served on one as a parent, and we worked really, really hard, and the administration came to the meetings, and it was a high school, so we had, some thoughtful teenagers that were there. And everything went along splendidly until we made a decision that the principal didn't like. And he vetoed it, and the whole heart went out of that site council. We couldn't get people to come anymore because they said, what's the point? And the principal, in my mind, a really good guy, was not willing to take the risk to deal with the thoughtful approaches on an issue. And it wasn't a particularly big one, by the way. It was where people were going to sit in the football stadium. He wasn't willing to take the risk to let the site council's decision fail in terms of its application. He just decided it was wrong and he was going to veto it. And what I'm afraid of is the state acting like that principal and not willing to take a risk of really looking at local governments as partners. And that would be very, very unfortunate, I think. But it's what I know happens in other circumstances, and I would have some concern that the state, in really trying to maintain mandates that it feels are necessary, that it will say no to things that it ought to say yes to and working as partners with you. So,
Madam Chair,
if you want to respond to that comment, and then I'll call on other people.
Madam Chair, I think you are right. When we went into this process, we thought that this was all about just making decisions. And if, you know, you'd have A, B, C, D, and E, whatever, we'll just make decisions. What we have learned over the last 3 years or 4 years is that this is about a culture, about changing the cultural relationship between the state and with us and on county boards. We have, and we've been working very hard, and we have tried, for instance, this year, and hopefully you have not heard a lot of county commissioners just coming in and making a lot of negative sounds about the cuts and all that stuff, is that we feel like some of the things are beyond our control, but we need to, if we're not here with solutions, if we're not creating a culture where we look to improve our state, then it's very difficult for us to be here. But the second part of it is all of this, that cultural work, is built on trust. There are times that the state-county relationship has felt more like a parent-child relationship, where the parent is telling us what to do. And I'd actually use Senator Osteen's bill of requiring the travel report be reviewed every year. That's almost a parental kind of response that says, we don't trust you to actually look at this thing on a yearly basis, so we're going to require you to do that. We are asking, I think, one more preface to this. We didn't earn your trust very well at times. We had a lot of counties in the 1970s that their social services program was a bus ticket to the Twin Cities.
And that will not happen again.
It will not happen. Mm-hmm. I guarantee you it will not happen again. But that's an embarrassment, and I think we need to make sure that our commissioners understand their responsibilities as we make these changes of what is accountable. So trust, I think, is a huge piece of what we need to work on. And if we fail, and there will be cities and counties or whomever that will fail at times, we need to understand that that your accountability and responsibility that goes with being trusted. But we believe that if we don't do that, if we don't move to that kind of system, we will be, and you will be, weighted down with this relationship that just will not be successful.
Thank you. Senator Roebling?
Thank you. As well as the state-county relationship, I think this committee would have concern over the county-city relationships and how those entities could work more efficiently together as well. And I don't know if you have set up any best practices for local counties and cities to model. I think of Carver County. They have one police department in their whole county, and the sheriff's department contracts with all the rest of the cities to provide their police protection. And different city leaders have at times thought, well, we should start our own department. And then they did the bookwork, and they realized they're much better off contracting with the county because of things like what you said, that the county can afford to have those top investigators who might do a murder investigation or a big drug bust, more often than each of those little cities would have. I see that as a best practice. Is there any way to get cities and counties to do that? Now, in Scott County, we have an organization called the Scott County Association for Leadership and Efficiency, SCALE, and we have the leaders of cities, counties, school boards, and townships meet every single month. They get together and talk about how we can do things together more efficiently. And they've come up with a number of suggestions. Some they're looking at, but our transit program went from cities trying to do their own thing to the county kind of overseeing it and getting much better service for the same dollars because we've got this much better coordinated system now. They're looking at parks now. Does every city need a parks manager? Or could the county kind of collaborate and work with them on that so that each city isn't doing it? I just think that there's a lot of opportunities, and I know there's silos and there's turf protection, and it's really hard to overcome. At least in Scott County, they're coming willingly to the table at this point, but I don't know at which point they're going to start to resist if they say, okay, you're not going to do that anymore. It's going to be taken over by somebody else. But so far, we haven't seen that resistance because they've all come in from the ground level and are working on it together. But do you see that happening in that whole city-county relationship, too? What can we do with that?
Mr. Mulder?
Thank you, Senator. You are SCALE is one of the model programs that we encourage counties, and it's taken literally 4 years to get to where they have gotten to. But, yes, we, on a monthly basis, the executive directors of the League of Minnesota Cities, the School Board Association, and myself meet and talk about this kind of stuff. And then we have what we call the Big Three, which meet on a quarterly basis, which are the executive committees from the three groups, to basically talk about these kinds of things and talk about where the opportunities. And we have started a project which will, we hope, over the course of the next year, look for and encourage local communities to find best practices. One of the places that we think there's a tremendous opportunity is in the area of computer technology. Currently, everybody buys a big box, and it's only the length of the cord between the big box and to where you need it. We are looking at, and what we're realizing is that the operational side of a computer is what costs a lot of money, and the storage side is what's cheaper, but you pay a lot of money for storage. So if we can share storage or if we can lease storage, there are a lot of positive ways that we can make save money for our communities. I have to tell you the interesting story on the police issue. They did a study in California in a county there that was looking to go to a police service, and they found that the number one concern about combining police forces was that the city, and this would be under a sheriff system, is that the city would not have a car that said the city's name on it. And so to resolve the problem, they bought cars that when they are for that city that are under the control of the sheriff. And they say there's a little tag on the bottom is that, you know, the county sheriff department, but it says the city on the side of the car. And everybody is just happy as can be because that was their biggest concern is losing identity. Well, and we don't do enough of thinking around, how do you think around problems versus seeing those problems as ways that will never be resolved.
Any other comments or questions for Mr. Mulder at this point? Well, thank you very much for your presentation, and we will have ongoing conversations with you, Senator Laurel, and Senator Gerlach, and myself, and then finally the committee.
All right. Thank you, Senator.
Welcome. Senator Bach. Senator Bach brings us Senate File 233, Constitutional Amendment to Change the Method to Propose Amendments to the State Constitution. Welcome to the committee, Senator Bach, and we're pleased to have you before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This constitutional amendment is probably a little different than ones we've seen in recent years. I don't think there are going to be rallies out on the Capitol steps. You remember in 2006, that amendment, the transportation amendment that dedicated the sales tax on motor vehicles to the Highway Trust Fund, had a very powerful alliance of different transportation and transit advocates supporting it. They spent millions of dollars on a campaign, on a vote yes campaign. If you remember the license plates, yard sign saying vote yes, and little or no opposition on the other side. And then the most recent one in 2008, big rallies at the Capitol. I don't know if they called it the Duck Rally or the Orange Hats. And we got another amendment on the ballot. And a very organized campaign. I would argue they did a very, very good job promoting a yes vote. I'm not sure that many of the people that voted yes last November on that amendment, I don't think we're really sure of what the uses of the money was potentially going to be. And I think some of those people that voted yes when this legislature concludes their budget in May are going to ask themselves if that's really what they voted for when they see the spending priorities coming out of this legislative session. And so I started taking a look at this whole notion of putting things on the ballot. And because I think there's a sentiment around here that the Constitution is really hard to change, that it's hard to garner up enough votes. And what I came across is there's a very good House research document that was updated in 2004. And in it, they go through, and there's a table of all the constitutional amendments that have been proposed. And there's been a total of, the report goes through 2004, and I think we had one in 2006 and one in 2008. So if I'm right, then there's 213 have been proposed. They've been proposed on 179 different subject areas, and 120 have passed. 120 out of 179.
Oh.
But what was more troubling about that was I looked at the information going back to the 1982 election, and since 1982 to now, there have been 18 proposed, 17 have passed. So I think the notion that it's hard to change the Constitution is a misnomer around here. And I think as legislators, maybe we don't give those constitutional amendment bills enough scrutiny before we allow them to go to the ballot. And I can just tell you, I was very disappointed when the most recent constitutional amendment was on the floor. And I heard Senator Marty and I actually offered an amendment to change the constitutional dedication of the sales tax increase to a statutory dedication of a sales tax increase. And it failed on the floor. And I was disappointed to hear members get up and say, well, I don't view this as a tax increase. We're letting the people decide. And it just seems like we're shirking some of our responsibility. Now, I say that because I've never been a supporter of initiative and referendum, but changing the Constitution is much like that. You know, we create with that transportation constitutional amendment, I believe we left, once that phased in over, I believe, 5 years, I believe there was about a $300 million hole in the general fund after that, and it had wide support and it passed. The most recent one, this last November, I think recently now it's being scored at about $250 million a year, that sales tax increase. But what bothers me about these two most recent ones, as we start to do the state budget through the Constitution, is where's the opposition? You know, we've had two most recent campaigns that dedicate large sums of money constitutionally for specific purposes, and the campaigns have been one-sided. They've been a vote yes campaign with token or no opposition. And we're dedicating a big piece, taking out of the control of the legislature, big pieces of state revenue. And I kind of liken it to, you know, how are the voters supposed to know how they should vote when all they hear is one side? And I started thinking about that, and I thought, well, you know what, it would be like a U.S. Senate election where Norm Coleman and Al Franken ran, and only one side could advertise. How would the public know what the right decision is? And raising money for an amendment to the Constitution, if you have a strong advocacy network, it's easier probably to raise money to vote yes than it is to vote no. And so I'm not wed to the words. I mean, if somebody has some ideas to make the actual ballot question better, I'm certainly interested in that. But I just think, you know, we require a 60% vote of the legislative body in order to put the state in debt. And it just seems reasonable to me that we have this, at least the same kind of threshold to pass a constitutional amendment to get it on the ballot. Just seems like a reasonable request.
Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Bach, have you looked back at these constitutional amendments and charted out what the vote was in the legislature? Was it always just barely a majority? Or would any of them have reached the three-fifths threshold?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, no, I haven't. And I don't know how important that information is. I mean, I think the most recent one and the one before it probably had more than enough votes to garner the 60%. I'm just really concerned, members, as we go forward, we're in very difficult budget times, that more interest groups come to the legislature and want to get their little piece of the budget guaranteed in the Constitution. And that really is going to erode the legislature's power down the road. And taking flexibility away from the legislature to respond to changing priorities, I think, is problematic. And let me use early childhood funding as the example. You know, I think when I came to the legislature in 1995 was my first session. I don't believe we even had a committee on early childhood. And we certainly didn't have a funding category for early childhood. We didn't know how important it was. And then the University of Minnesota came out with a bunch of research, and we all learned a lot about the amount, the volume of brain development that happens in those first 3 years of life. And the public and we decided that this is really important, that this is a really, really good investment for us. And the legislature responded because we had flexibility in our budget. We responded to new priorities. And what we don't know is what is going to be the priority 5 years, 10 years, 15 years out from now that we don't know today. And it just seems going forward, the legislature should have flexibility over the budget so you can respond to the people's priorities. And I'm very concerned that that more of the state budget starts to get put into the Constitution and members just decide that that's okay because we're letting the people decide. But I don't know if this would stop one from getting on the ballot, but I think making it a little harder because they apparently, in the most recent decades anyway, they're pretty easy to pass. So I think the legislature, I think, needs to put a little bit more scrutiny into putting them on the ballot than we have been.
You know, Senator Pappas, I think that, and Senator Bach, I think establishing a higher threshold for the legislature in the same way that we have a high threshold for the electorate to pass one is what appealed to me. I mean, it takes, as Senator Bach said, it takes 60% to put us into debt and or to pass a bonding bill. And it would seem to me that if we had a 60% threshold, that even if the recent pass would show that that was easily achieved, that there's a psychological impact when somebody proposes an amendment and says, okay, I can't just get 34 votes. I've got to make sure I've got, what is 60%? 41 solid. And we may find that there are fewer amendments proposed because people know that they're going to have to do, they're not just going to have to depend on the advocacy groups, for example, to get the votes, but that it's really going to have to appeal. I just think there'll be a psychological impact, even in the public, of saying people, well, we to put this on the ballot, we had to get 60% of the legislature to say yes. And that would be regardless of what the recent pass has been. Senator Marty and then Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I want to second what Senator Bach was saying about the ease of amending the Constitution. I think most of us feel amending the Constitution is a much bigger deal than amending laws. And yet the amount of attention that gets paid to it here, it's not just shirking responsibility by taking our budget decisions and putting them off to the public, but I think sometimes the whole idea of thinking through this, it's been used as, well, let's let the people decide on the whole range of issues. So it's almost like, well, we're just interfering with the public's vote on something instead of we're supposed to go through a very thoughtful process. The people who wrote our Constitution and set this process in place presumably wanted to have two steps so we wouldn't frivolously amend the Constitution. And I think that the legislature is basically, in many times in recent years, has punted our share of it, saying, well, we'll leave it so it's sort of initiative and referendum. People can decide some of these things and we'll decide other ones, but the fact that we have our share, I very much agree with what you said, that 60% would psychologically make people realize it's not just, well, let's get this through quickly so the voters can decide. We've got a big decision here to make that's going to bind future legislatures and future the state of Minnesota for 25, 30 years, depending on the amendment, or permanently. And therefore, we ought to take it much more seriously than a normal bill. Instead, I think the opposite has been true. So I guess I think this is much needed, and I appreciate your bringing it.
Senator Betzel?
Well, but I'll hearken back to Senator Pappas's comment. I haven't, I can just rely upon my own memory of Senate votes. But I think in the years that I've been here, I think that most of the proposed constitutional changes, at least that came through the Senate, passed by pretty overwhelming votes, if I recall. I don't know that this alone makes it harder. I think it should be very difficult to change the Constitution, not impossible, because, this is the will of the people. They ultimately will decide what the Constitution says. But I think just changing to 3/5 of the members of the legislature, I don't think that makes it harder because, again, if the argument is, well, let the people decide, that's, I think, how most of the proposals have gotten through in the past. It would be a much different matter if the number of voters to approve a constitution, if that threshold was raised. I mean, right now they say it's hard because the you've got the no votes, and the people who don't vote are counted as no's. But you're still talking a couple million people that voted yes, at least in the last one. Whether they understood it or not, it's a different matter. But I think if you're really going to say make it harder to deal with it, I think it's not so much the legislature. I think it's the electorate making it harder to pass it.
Senator Betzel, when we go back, however, and look at the amendment that was on the ballot in 2008. Senator Lessard started years ago to try and get a ballot question for a sales tax increase to support habitat and conservation and so on. And it would come close, but it wouldn't even get to the 50%. And then there was the going back and forth about whether it would be an additional tax or part of the tax base. And by making a decision, he got a little bit, or whoever was doing it then, Senator Sands, got a little bit more support. And then finally the arts started coming into it. And at that point, they got 60% of the vote in the legislature. And I think that's an indication that even within the legislature, of building coalitions to get to that threshold, at least in some people's minds, the proponents, I didn't vote for it, but in the proponents' minds, that they were gathering support at a level at which they could say that the legislature was behind this, and then Senator Pogamiller, at least on the Senate side, eventually being the article. I do think it's a modest step, but I do think it's one that will make make the process just a little bit more thoughtful. Senator Pappas?
Does Senator Roebling have something?
Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bach, the one thing that surprised me about constitutional amendments is that the governor had no authority over them. If we passed them with 50% plus one, they went right on the ballot. Did you think about possibly including the governor in the process so that he could have, he or she could have veto authority? And then an override would take 3/5. And you know, it would be another, it would be kind of, or maybe you want to do both. I don't know if both would work, because then the 3/5 wouldn't be that relevant. But I was surprised when the governor was left out of the process, and I don't know why that was ever decided.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I'm not sure we want to let one person be the governor, make the decision whether something can get on the ballot or not. Because I think ultimately that's what you would do. The governor would decide. And no matter what political party you're in, I mean, overriding the governor of your party is a pretty gutsy thing to do. And it doesn't happen very often around here. And I think that probably would unduly give the power to offer amendments to the Constitution to the governor.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
just a quick correction. It takes 2/3 to override the governor, not 3/5. So it's actually a higher threshold to override the governor.
Oh, right. Yeah. Senator right. Roebling. Senator Gerlach is next.
Well, Madam Chair,
I did want
to speak. It's just that Senator Roebling had her hand up before.
Oh, that's
me.
Right. Okay. Senator Pappas then Senator Gerlach.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and Senator Bach, I think there's something going on in the electorate where the voters really like the idea of knowing exactly what their tax dollars are funding, and they have more trouble with the general fund. You know, I hear that a lot where, you know, and that's what they like about the constitutional amendment is they can say, well, this is exactly where this money is going to. And I'm wondering if we need to think about that more as we put a budget together. Is, and not do it constitutionally, but do it statutorily, where we identify these dollars that we raise, whether it's, you know, sales tax or income tax, and we specify exactly what that is going to pay. I think there's a lot of transparency there when the public can say, okay, if we don't have enough money in this pot, it means that we're not able to provide the kind of service that the public expects, or, you know, vice versa. We have too much money in this pot, and we're providing too luxurious a service. Whatever, that'll never happen, but just in case. So I'm just wanted you to think about that a little bit, and for the finance chairs to think about that too, that that might be something that could help people feel more confidence and trust in their government.
Good point. Senator Gerlach, and then I'll come back to Betzel and Marty.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just want to say something briefly that I think this is a great bill. And the biggest concern I have that I share with Senator Bach is this budgeting by constitutional amendment. It's just horrendous, and we have to get away from that. And there's only just two regrets that I have. One is that I'm not the chief author of this. That, you know, it's okay that you are, but you probably have a far better chance of passing this than I would. So that's good. But and the other one is that we can't make this retroactive.
Well, that's a bigger issue.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, that would be a very big amendment to this amendment. I wanted to comment on Senator Betzel's discussion of the percentage needed. I recall with this last one in the Senate Tax Committee, I think Senator Bach and myself and Senator Langseth and two or three others, we succeeded at amending the bill once in committee to make it statutory dedication instead of constitutional. And then Senator Pogomiller got the votes and came back and undid it. But I think a lot of the sense that I heard from other people who thought this was a horrendous way to budget and bad policy were saying, well, you know, it's going to pass anyway. And I think if you had a 60% threshold, I think that, Madam Chair, what you were referring to earlier psychologically, I think it gives a chance. Well, we should stand up on this because we think it's wrong. We think we have a chance of winning. If it's a 60% threshold, I think there is some of that. And but I think it's, even if they would pass, I think it's important to have a higher threshold. I think maybe people will take it, recognize there's extra obligation for serious consideration of this. And Senator Pappas, to your comments about the public, this building confidence in government that they can dedicate funds, I'm not sure that's the impact. I think the vote last year was, do we want to put more money into environment and arts and natural resources? I think the decision was, yeah, we'd like to. I think if you put one on the ballot for education, yeah, we'd like to. Put one on the ballot to make it harder or to cut taxes, yeah, we'd like that too. I think the voters are saying, given this choice, we'd rather put more money in, or if the choice was Proposition 13 type of thing, we'd like to limit taxing. I don't think it's the voters trying to pick priorities, and because it's not, they're not given a choice of priorities. They're given one decision. Right. And I think in Missouri, where the motto for our last constitutional amendment came from, I keep hearing how their DNR has the latest in computers and everything else, and the rest of the state government is backwards in terms of their technology and so on. And I'm not sure the voters would – I'm not sure that's what the voters want. I think it's, you give them one choice, and they make their best decision based on what that one choice is. You're not giving them the whole picture that we're supposed to deal with.
Senator Day?
Madam Chair, I think that – whether we like it or not, for the last 100 years, everybody runs for office, and they run against their opponent, and they run against government. They say, oh, if I get in there, I'll clear it up, and whatever, whatever. It's like selling Coca-Cola. Pretty soon, people want to buy some Coca-Cola. The people like the idea that they get a chance to go vote on something and not allow us to tell them how to always spend their money, because they're not saying that they think we're spending it in the right way all the time. This allows people, and I will tell you, if you're in the minority, I know Senator Gerlach thinks this is a great bill, if you're in the minority and it goes on for a long length of time, you have a very, very hard time getting anything of any substance normally passed if you have a different idea of what the majority does. But if you can get by and get it on the ballot, you might have a chance of, convincing 60-70% of the people. So, how do you go wrong letting people vote on something? I suppose it could get out of hand like California with all the different propositions, but in the votes that we've had, so be it. I mean, 56% of the people go and actually say, I want to tax myself for something, whatever, in this case, the environment and the arts, and or I want to tax myself on vehicle license plates or gas or gosh only knows. So I don't know what is wrong with letting, I guess I asked Senator Bach, what is wrong with letting people vote? Who says that we're a better keeper of people's money than they are?
Well, Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Senator Day, I think the issue is this committee table gives us, when we're considering a piece of legislation, gives us the opportunity to hear both sides of every subject. Legislators have more information than the general public does when they look at a ballot question. And in the case of the last couple, they didn't know anything about what voting no might mean. There might have been an upside to voting no, but they didn't know. But legislators and in the Capitol here, with the process we have, when we make decisions, we like to think that we've heard both sides of the question, and that's very difficult to do through the Constitution. I mean, the California Proposition 13, where I believe it's 13, where your property taxes are frozen when you buy your home until you sell it. I'll bet if we put it on the ballot, that would pass. That would pass. But from a policy standpoint, we all know in this room that there's some unfairness in that, that when the parents who've lived in the home for 30 years have their property tax frozen and their children buy the home next door and their property tax is maybe two or three times as much as the parents for a home of the same value when they're receiving the same kind of services from the local government, something's unfair about that. It might be popular, and I would argue it probably will pass, but I think we all know that we would build a property tax system with a great deal of inequities in it, and if I was a commercial property tax owner, I'd be very worried about the extent to which property taxes would shift onto the commercial industrial property, and how might that impact future economic activity in the state when our commercial industrial property taxes, because we've frozen our homeowners, when the burden of the cost of local government is being borne largely by commercial industrial property. And it, Senator Day, it may likely be very popular with the public, but the public doesn't get the opportunity to engage in the discussion that we have here about where the mine, to navigate the minefield of something like freezing somebody's property taxes, what are the other impacts in the community to other taxpayers? So I think sometimes we just have more information, Senator Day, and I think I think when people vote for us, they understand we're going to gather that information. They expect us to gather that information and use our best judgment. And I just think making it a little harder is a good thing. I remember when Senator Lessard came with the Missouri plan, and many of you were here. I think that's how it was first promoted, as the Missouri plan. It was 3/16 of the sales tax. And it did take about 10 years or more before that finally got the votes in the legislature. And maybe it was a better plan than when it was initially proposed, but it would have taken it a long time to get to 60%. The way it was initially proposed.
And Senator Day, I think, you know, you made the point of the participation of the minority in deciding these things. And I would point out that for the better part of this decade, the majority party didn't have 60%. And the only way, if this passed, that an amendment would have gotten on the ballot by a vote of the Senate would have depended on votes from the minority party. It couldn't happen otherwise. Now it can happen in the Senate, and I don't make.
Yes.
They have 60% in the House too. But for the greater part of this decade, it couldn't have gotten on there without participation by the minority party members.
Madam Chair,
and it has nothing to do with the voting on the ballot. This proposal doesn't speak to making any changes about what the people's voice is. It's just how strong the support is to put it to the people.
Madam Chair, and as we all know, in Congress, you have to have 60%
right.
Now in the Senate, which is causing, you know, so maybe that would be something you'd want to incorporate in your bill. And maybe when we put it on the ballot, maybe down on line 111, it should be if 3/5 of all the electors voting at the election vote to ratify an amendment.
Madam Chair, Senator Day, my intent wasn't to make it harder for the voters. My intent was for the legislature to give a little bit of additional consideration to it, and let's make it a little harder on ourselves. I hadn't intended to make it harder for the voters.
Madam Chair, I realize that's why I didn't offer it as amendment. I didn't want to. but I guess I'll end by saying that I don't think we've had that many pass in the state. You said there's 120. And I like input from people. And we have a lot of inequities in elections. I mean, inequities in whether you have a lot of money or you don't have money, or there's just a lot of things that are out there. And it seems like the last election was a good example. I will tell you that I thought in my Senate district it would go down by a huge margin. And when it was over, I looked at it and I go, wow, people in my community was interested in arts. They were interested in the environment, and overwhelmingly. Now, I can honestly tell you that I thought totally different. So if I was to sit on the Senate floor and vote for my district, I would have been totally wrong. And in the long run, was that a good vote or a bad vote? I don't know. We'll know probably in 10 or 15 years, but it probably was a good vote. It seems like there's an awful lot of people that are very interested in those two issues. So anyway, that's
The motion on the bill would be, of course, to send the bill to the Rules Committee, because if prior practice is any guide, there won't be any constitutional amendments taken up this year. They would be, and we have some others coming as well, by the way.
Madam Chair, why is that?
Because Senator Pogomiller usually doesn't. He takes them up in the year in which they go on the ballot. The MVEST one, because it was in the transportation bill, got voted on the year earlier, but that's not been his practice in the past.
I'm sure it's just Senator Pogomiller, it's just because the issue cannot go on the ballot until a general election year. The legislature typically doesn't spend the time the first year.
Yeah, just not going to spend the time on it the first year.
Madam Chair, I think the only reason to pass one a year earlier is to give the Vote Yes campaign an opportunity to start raising money, because they know they're going to have an issue. And I think that's what happened in the two most recent ones, is they wanted to give the people who wanted to promote it an additional opportunity to raise money, and they were successful at that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Day.
If we're not, if Senator Pogomiller isn't for it, then why are we taking this one up?
Because we got a hearing request, and we're going to, and we're going to probably take constitutional amendments up. We'll take them up this session to pass them on, but we're probably going to take them up as a group.
No, please know that, Madam Chair, that I don't care that we take it up. That's fine with me, but it seems to me, why not take them up, vote on them, and we'll set them aside until next election.
Okay, so we have Senate File 233. Senator Gerlach moves that Senate File 233 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in support or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Bach. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
There being no let's see. Before you go, on Wednesday.
Right, and you have to vote.
John.
Okay. On Wednesday, we're going to spend half of the committee on half of the time on the full committee, and then at approximately 4 o'clock, we're going to meet as a election subcommittee. And in the next couple of weeks, we're probably going to be taking up a lot of the time. Senator Sieben has worked out with the committee administrator a schedule where we're going to be hearing elections bills. So we'll probably be meeting in the subcommittee on elections. But this Wednesday, for those of you that aren't on elections, you can be excused at 4 o'clock. If you want to stay and hear the discussion, you're certainly welcome to do that. But Senator Day, you don't need to be there. That's right.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So
we do, and we do encourage you to be there and stay so that you're familiar with the bills when they come before the full committee, and you're certainly welcome to also not only listen but to fully participate in asking questions and comment. There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.
Well, what, I'm